of the most controversial clinical and research issues in management of non-small cell lung cancer is stage 3 disease, and a critical current study being conducted by the RTOG and SWOG is being chaired by thoracic oncology surgeon Dr. Harvey Pass. I met with Dr. Pass to find out more about this critical trial and the implications to daily practice, and he began our conversation by providing an overview of the issues involved.
The question of how to treat stage 3A lung cancer has been a vexing one. There have been a number of studies that have performed induction therapy for 3A disease, 3A nodal disease, two that were highly touted for induction chemotherapy that had very small accrual but were deemed as positive with a survival advantage to those patients with 3A disease who received induction cisplatin-based therapy. By the same token, there were phase 2 trials that were looking at the combination of chemotherapy and radiation therapy, and this culminated in a randomized trial that was performed by Dr. Kathy Albane, which has been presented at ASCO in a subsequent presentation at ASCO. That trial, essentially, which was asking the question of which was better, induction chemo radiation therapy or definitive chemo radiation therapy without surgery for 3A disease, accumulated patients slowly, but then when it was presented, was felt to be a negative study for surgery. In other words, the survival of the patients who had surgery after induction chemo radiation therapy really was not any better than patients who had definitive chemo radiation therapy, although the progression-free survival had a trend toward improvement. The problem, though, was that if you looked at the data carefully, there was a high mortality rate for patients who had pneumonectomies. And this is something that was commented on by a number of individuals even while this trial was going on from other institutions. And this played out in this trial such that you had a 14% operative mortality with the pneumonectomies for a total operative mortality of 7%. So this gave one pause. And also the reason for the pneumonectomies was that the stratification of who had lymph node disease and the size of lymph node disease really wasn't stratified for in this. Well, be that as it may, a subsequent analysis, which was not a pre-planned analysis, was presented by Albane at a follow-up ASCO in which they carefully tried to match the patients in the definitive chemo radiation therapy group to patients who had lobectomies, not pneumonectomies. And sure enough, there was a survival advantage then to the lobectomy group that was fairly dramatic, but again, an uncalled for analysis. So this next trial was planned with the idea that a different question was going to be asked, meaning the 0412 trial, the new trial. A different question would be asked, which is, what is the role of radiation therapy? But also, we'd be a little bit smarter about who we'd put into this trial to try to avoid the pneumonectomy issue. And that is by carefully stratifying the nodal disease into microscopic or clinically apparent, and also using mediastinoscopy to tell us how many stations were involved. Well, essentially, we're not going to have the bulkier disease in this trial. So although there's controversy about this trial, it's an important question because we still do not know which is better, induction chemo alone or induction chemo radiation therapy, and that's the basic tenet of the trial.
How do you approach these patients off study?
I think that we approach the patients off study in an evolving way, and evolving because of the technology. If you have a patient that comes to see you that now presents with 3A disease that's histologically documented, and you do not think they're going to need to have a right pneumonectomy, many multidisciplinary clinics will look at that patient and say, well, what do we think at our institution is best? At my institution, we feel that induction chemo radiation therapy off trial has merit because of the increased local effects of radiation therapy. So those patients would be given radiation therapy concurrent with usually a platinum-based regimen up to approximately 4,500 centigrade, reevaluated quickly by CT scan And then we would decide whether that patient is then going to be operated on. But the difference that's happened since the Albane trial is that we no longer consider big, bulky, 3-centimeter nodes that are really obviously not going to be able to be removed without a pneumonectomy, or large central lesions that require pneumonectomy. We usually move on to give those patients definitive chemoradiation therapy. So it's an individualized view. And, you know, we also would like to know before we operate whether the lymph nodes have been sterilized. Because in the trials, I'm pretty convinced that if you have nodal sterilization, and that's lymph node sterilization, not talking about tumor sterilization, but concentrating on lymph node, the data from the Albane trial, the data from other trials have shown that those patients seem to have a selective survival advantage if you sterilize those lymph nodes. So we need to move into a situation where we can evaluate those lymph nodes in a non-invasive or minimally invasive way so we can spare the patients an operation if the lymph nodes are persistently positive. And there's controversy about that also, because some individuals feel that the best chance for the patient, even if the lymph nodes are still positive, if it's microscopic, then you should operate. My own feeling is that with the advent of new endobronchial techniques, we'll be able to find that out before we take the patient to the operating room, and it will give us pause if the patient does not have a sterilization.
You mentioned the issue of the right-sided versus left-sided pneumonectomy. How strong are the data in separating those two out, and what's sort of the pathophysiologic reason that right is more difficult?
Nobody really knows why that's so. The studies that have looked at pneumonectomies always have found a higher mortality on the right side. It was felt that this was due to the increased volume of lung on the right side to begin with. With regard to induction chemoradiation therapy and selective right-sided abnormalities, it's speculative with regard to why the right side is worse than the left. Number one, what you run into problems with this is bronchial problems and adult respiratory distress syndrome, with or without bronchial problems. And to have a left lung remaining, which was a smaller lung to begin with, that also had the ravages of smoking on it, and the developed ARDS can have a mortality as high as 60%. So on the right side, we do a lymph node dissection that takes the level 4s, the level 7s. There's been some thought that maybe that's interfering with the bronchial artery blood supply. Maybe that's doing something to the bronchus, giving them a greater chance for bronchial problems. I think that's completely speculative, and we can avoid that by putting a patch, either muscle or thymic fat, on the stump to try and protect it from breaking down postoperatively. On the left side, less lung tissue, but also less of a dissection that's really on top of the bronchus itself. And also on the left side with a pneumonectomy, that bronchus tucks itself right under the aortic arch, which is almost like a protective area for it where the stump can be protected. It's all speculative, but the data are there, and we have to be careful of right pneumonectomies.
How much variation is there in terms of the surgeon doing the operation, a surgeon who does a large volume of surgery in a tertiary care center as opposed to a surgeon in the community, particularly as it relates to pneumonectomy?
I think that's a very, very good point. I mean, you need to have surgeons who, in my opinion, approach thoracic surgery every day and have a concentrated interest in thoracic surgery. There is no doubt that the data that's been published, starting with Silvestri's data in chest from a study done in South Carolina, that shows that board-certified cardiothoracic surgeons have a better immediate mortality rate in general thoracic surgery as opposed to non-board-certified cardiothoracic surgeons. And in fact, the data with regard to long-term endpoints are better, cancer endpoints in patients who have had the same operation, if it's done by a thoracic surgeon, the data is superior. And I think that dealing with intraoperative decisions of whether you're going to do a pneumonectomy or a sleeve to try and save a portion of the lung, these are very difficult decisions sometimes that have to be carefully thought out. So you need to have an experienced thoracic surgeon, hopefully trained in a high-volume thoracic oncology program by surgeons who are known for doing induction type of therapies and then operating, so that the community will have access to those individuals.
Can you dissect out, so to speak, sort of a little bit more about what experienced surgeons do differently than those who are less experienced? How much of it is technical skill? How much is post-operative care? Where is the difference?
Across all levels, all of it true. I mean, the assessment of the CT before the operation as to whether this is going to be a pneumonectomy or whether you're going to be able to do a sleeve and save the lower lobe, say, on the right side. Number two, the lymph node dissection. The majority of surgeons, thoracic surgeons, have been trained from data from Toronto as well as Sloan Kettering that the preferred technique is a lymph node dissection with regard to getting the greatest amount of information. So thoracic surgeons will differ with regard to how much of a lymph node dissection they will do and what stations they will take and how much of the station they will take. And the general belief, at least in my thought and many thoracic colleges, is that a dissection is superior to a sampling where you just take a piece of one node and, you know, sometimes you don't even get all the stations with a sampling. The technical prowess of making the intraoperative decision and how you handle the bronchus and whether you flap the bronchus is fairly standard, but certainly you have to know some tricks postoperatively in these patients. These patients have been sensitized to oxygen. They may develop ARDS because of increased oxygen concentrations in the operating room, depending upon the agent that was used before the operation. These patients are prone to have albumins that can go very, very low, leading to respiratory insufficiency. So you have to be very, very careful with that. And you have to keep these patients dry so that they don't get a congested lung if they have a pneumonectomy that's going to lead them to ARDS. So the surgeon has to be critical in managing the really minute details, even as volume management postoperatively in dealing with this induction situation.
What kinds of complications or issues result from using chemotherapy and/or radiation therapy before surgery?
Yeah, I mean, it depends upon the agent, but there certainly can be sensitization that if you use, for example, with mitomycin C, if you give high levels of oxygen in the operating room or bleomycin, you can actually have an oxygen toxicity sort of situation postoperatively in which the patient may develop infiltrates that you confuse with either a pneumonitis, but it may be indeed an acute free radical oxygen toxicity situation. Radiation therapy obviously will interfere long-term with healing and cause fibrosis, so the surgeon needs to plan the timing of the operation very, very carefully. You want to have a situation where you're operating on the patient about 4 to 6 weeks. Now, that's not written in stone, but certainly that is a period after the completion of the radiation therapy where you have not yet deposited real big scar that makes the dissection even more difficult if you wait. Granted, there are data that you can operate late after radiation therapy and at high dose radiation therapy, but that's not the standard of care at this point. It's in protocol, phase two protocol at this point. So we want to operate before you have the dense fibrosis to make it safer. Obviously, the agents that used to cause cardiac toxicity we really don't use for lung cancer now, like adriamycin, but you have to be aware that the patient, depending upon your radiation oncologist, may have had some radiation effect on the heart, but that's really not an acute effect. So the real issues are sensitivity to oxygen and wound healing.
In this very specific clinical scenario, how much of a variation do you think there is in the quality of the radiation oncologist?
Oh, I think it's very important. The days of the huge ports that are going to cover huge lymph node basins as well as the lesion can now be done in a more precise treatment planning mode with CT scanning and volumetric reconstruction that I think is very important to spare normal tissue so that patients before the operation will have less esophagitis so that they're maintaining their nutrition, so that they're better surgical candidates when they come to the operating room. And also with regard to the postoperative complications with some sort of late radiation pneumonitis or cardiac toxicity. So I think you need to have somebody who uses all the modern techniques for port placement and has been trained so.
Any feeling for how much heterogeneity there is out there right now in the community in terms of radiation oncologists being able to do that?
can't comment on that because there may be some very talented community radiation oncologists who came from very high-profile programs such as MD Anderson or from Michigan or from Sloan Kettering that are hired and really have got the idea of how to treat this patient with the newest techniques. I would believe, though, that there's a limit to how many of those individuals are trained every year. So I would venture a guess that, yes, there is some heterogeneity out there, and that for any trials that you do for induction chemoradiation therapy, there has to be quality control, not only on the surgical side, but on the radiation oncology side and the medical oncology side.
What about your study? And if you could talk specifically about what the trial number is and a little bit more about the design, and also what kind of controls do you have for quality in terms of both the surgery and radiation oncology?
Right. The N is approximately 584 patients to try and show a 10% increase in survival for patients who get induction chemoradiation therapy over induction chemo alone. Study chairs will be reviewing the surgery as well as the adverse events for medical oncology as well as the radiation oncology ports. This is going to be done as a quality control afterwards. For the surgery aspect of it, we have surgical forms that are filled out by the individual centers so we know how many lobectomies or pneumonectomies have been done by the individual. We know how many specifically induction cases have been done per year by the individual. And we also know whether the individual has been certified by the American Board of Thoracic Surgeons. So we also, with regard to the translational correlates, the PET scanning, we're trying to compare apples to apples by saying that the PETs that are done preoperatively need to be done at the same institution post-treatment so that those can be compared.
Can you talk a little bit about what it's like to get informed consent for someone to allow randomization to, you know, thoracic surgery or not?
That's tough. That was the problem with the trial that Dr. Albane was doing. I mean, to approach somebody when in somebody's heart of hearts, they want to have surgery to remove this and they feel good about it, to go and present a case to them that we're going to randomize you as to whether you're going to get only non-surgical therapy versus surgical therapy and the chemo, it was a very tough sell. And that's why that trial took a very long time to accrue its numbers. This trial is a little different. The trial involves all the disciplines, and the patient doesn't feel like he is losing out by not having surgery because you're going to have surgery. We truly do not know, though, whether the response rate, whether the long-term survival is different between the two groups. And we also are offering a new chemotherapy regimen. So the advantages of this trial and talking to a patient and being able to tell them that if you're interested in surgery and we're trying to make the surgery safer by defining that you have disease that is amenable to a, let's just say, lobectomy and less resection, lobectomy being the standard, that's going to be more appealing. And I think that although it takes time to talk to patients, it'll be an easier sell.
Is the study up and running?
Study is up and running. The accrual is now picking up after about an 8-month period where it was difficult to get all the aspects of this trial done at the individual centers, specifically getting the surgical questionnaires all done and sent in so that each center knew that we were saying that they could be a part of the trial.
Now, are you allowing pneumonectomy?
We are allowing a pneumonectomy, absolutely. I mean, if you get in there and the patient needs a pneumonectomy, then we're going to allow it, but we're trying to decrease the number of pneumonectomies. Moreover, I think that we've done a better job in alerting thoracic surgeons to this, number one. And number two, it's thoracic surgeons. We're going to have thoracic surgeons taking care of these patients, making these decisions, so that hopefully the volume of pneumonectomies will be less and will only be in selected cases.
Can you talk about the chemotherapy regimen that's being utilized and why it was chosen?
The cisplatin taxotere regimen was the one that was used by Dr. Bettinger from the Swiss trials and really had promising response rates, as well as intermediate five-year survivals that were very promising in an induction trial that was done with induction cisplatin taxotere alone. That was subsequently followed up at the ISLC meeting, and the numbers held and were very similar to the Roth-Rossell type numbers that we had from before. So then the issue became, well, with this new regimen, could we then combine it with radiation therapy? And we did, but we reduced the doses so that it could be more compatible.
What has been seen in terms of how patients tolerate the regimen?
They tolerate it pretty well, but there's some mixed emotions about that. There are some centers that have commented that it's very easy to get the patients through and that the AEs are certainly manageable. And that is our experience at NYU. I mean, because that is the regimen that had been used at NYU even before I got there. And that seems to be the same thoughts as at other centers like Sloan Kettering. So I think that it's a manageable regimen that I think will be adaptable to the community very well, and it's already being used in the community.
Now, what about maintenance or post-operative chemotherapy? The SWOG 9504 regimen has docetaxel. What are you doing?
They're getting the same. They will be getting post-operative docetaxel after they are, let's just say, resected in a consolidation mode, and that is for both arms.
Let's talk a little bit about adjuvant therapy. I'm curious what your perspective is as a surgeon of how the data has evolved over the last few years, and particularly some of the controversies that have occurred about lower stage disease, such as 1B.
I think that the data, to me, points to tremendous efficacy of postoperative adjuvant therapy in the stage 2 or higher situation. With regard to 1A and 1B, I think that there is controversy and that surgeons are very skeptical for the majority, certainly with regard to 1A disease. And 1B disease has now become almost uninterpretable because, indeed, the majority of the studies are negative, including the most recent study from CalGB that, yes, has a 3-year survival advantage, but seems to be lost, at least now, with the follow-up ASCO presentation. So I think that, are there exceptions to this based on size, whether it's 4 centimeters or whatever, for a 1B. I think those data also need to be, you know, looked at prospectively and not as a post de facto analysis. So to sum up, my thoughts are that any patient that I operate on that has N1 disease postoperatively is going to be referred for a medical oncologic opinion. Certainly the microscopic occult 3A disease will be referred. And the 1Bs I'm selective with. If I have a patient that has a tumor that had lymphovascular invasion and is a fit individual or has a high SUV value, my gut tells me at least get a medical oncologist to see this patient and talk to the patient about the risks and the benefits of giving a cisplatin-based regimen. But 1A, I continue to say to my patients, you do not need adjuvant therapy at this point.
What are some of the other issues in surgery for lung cancer that you think oncologists should maybe be tuned into?
I think one of the biggest issues that they need to be tuned into is the idea of screening. I think oncologists are going to fall into this in that oncologists, I mean, if a patient has a lung cancer, what do you do as far as follow-up? And also for the high-risk individual, should screening be done? That is an incredibly controversial point. It's going to play into, for the oncologist, also chemo prevention trials for the high-risk individual. Chemo prevention trials, meaning for patients who have a certain tobacco consumption and who are a certain age, whether those individuals should be screened by CT or screened by sputum, and whether they should then fall into chemo prevention trials with new agents that are either COX inhibitors or LOX inhibitors or steroids such as budesonide. This is a completely different field that oncologists must be tuned into. Obviously, the other issues for oncologists and lung cancer and surgery will be, how are we going to take the new targeted agents to adjuvant and induction trials? And are we ready for that? And what targeted agents are we going to use? And what's the safety profile with those in an induction setting or in an adjuvant setting when the patient is supposedly free of disease? I think we're going to have to evaluate that very, very carefully, and that's going to be a different evaluation than chemotherapy alone.
And of course, the next generation of studies, and the biggest question, I think, at this point is going to be the addition of bevacizumab to chemotherapy, where, of course, you have the issue of wound healing. In other tumors, colon cancer particularly, there's been the thought of waiting 6 weeks and
right.
that things will, quote, be okay. Do you think that's the way it's going to play out with lung cancer?
I think it will. I think we're going to be very cautious with bevacizumab. And although I've operated on patients with bevacizumab already, and I really haven't seen any wound problems, I think that we will have to be careful, not only for the wound problems, but for having all the issues of hypertension taken care of and bleeding for that population that surgeons have to then deal with.
How do you utilize PET scanning in your practice?
I'm a very liberal PET getter in that I think PET is very useful even for the smallest of lesions, and even for the lesions that, let's just say, conventional wisdom says it's going to be negative because it's wispy and it's not solid or it's too small. I mean, number one, any patient I'm considering for surgery that has a solid nodule of any size, usually 1 centimeter, of course, or 8 millimeters or greater, they get a PET scan. And I want to not only look at the nodes, but I want to look at distant disease. I want to see how high the SUV is, which I think in future studies may be very, very important with regard to stratification. For patients who have non-solid nodules or mixed nodules or who have pure ground glass opacities, if I get a PET scan and I've already given a trial of antibiotics, so I know this is not an inflammatory lesion, and I have somebody who's in the high-risk category or even non-smokers these days who present with these ground glass opacities, and I have a PET-positive scan, that gives me more of a, let's just say, an impetus to follow this patient even closer or to discuss minimally invasive techniques at very high-quality centers for a needle biopsy of these lesions.
Anything new in terms of the technology of surgery for lung cancer or diagnosis that you think are going to have a big impact in the clinical setting in the near future?
I think that nodal evaluation is certainly changing. I think that the use of endobronchial techniques to do endobronchial ultrasound will eventually allow us to be very selective with regard to who we're going to mediastinoscope, and I think will allow us then to determine who in the post-treatment induction setting may have sterilization of lymph nodes so that we can document that without having to risk the patient with a mediastinoscopy, a repeat mediastinoscopy. I think that with regard to the minimally invasive techniques of surgery, that also is gaining a lot of, let's just say, information and data, but at selected centers where individuals do a lot of them and sort of concentrated at centers of excellence. The technique is being certainly brought into the community. I think that we have to be careful who would do minimally invasive techniques on, specifically video-assisted techniques, to make sure we don't skimp on the lymph node dissection, make sure we are able to get the level 7 lymph nodes very, very well, and to make sure our surgeons are going to get that for the medical oncologist because they need to have that information. Other things that are going to change is the whole idea of whether smaller nodules can have smaller operations. We're going to revisit that issue, and we're revisiting that issue already because of nodule heterogeneity and whether certain nodules may be more indolent than others or whether small size with a segmentectomy now and lymph node dissection may be amenable. These are data from the Japanese literature that may allow us to explore this better than we did in the 80s when we did the first randomized trial of sublobar versus lobar techniques.